You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, March 24th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Alec McGillis, author of Fulfillment, Winning and Losing in One Click America, is a senior reporter for ProPublica and the recipient of the George Polk Award, the Robin Toner Prize. Also on the program today, in the wake of two mass shootings, gun control moves to the forefront. Will this time be any different? Report shows intense Republican coordination for the widespread voter suppression legislation we're seeing being rolled out across the country. Meanwhile, conservative Democrats push to diminish the minimum wage targets set in the $15 minimum wage legislation bill. Meanwhile, Janet Yellen pledges to increase tax deductions for wealthy homeowners. Rashida Tlaib Premier Jayapal intro a bill to provide every American $2,000 a month. Former Yale professor says in a lawsuit that Alan Dershowitz, author of Cancel Culture, got her fired over a tweet that she made about Alan Dershowitz and Donald Trump. Saudi coalition that includes us, at least defensively, supposedly, bombs Yemeni's grain ports in the midst of a catastrophic famine in that country. Bibi Netanyahu's party Likud wins most seats in the Knesset, but short of a governing majority. And it's Equal Pay Day. Reminder, women make 82 cents for every dollar a man makes in the same job. Worse for single moms. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, that was abrupt. Sorry. We got to get a little bit of a better fader for that. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us today. Oh, as you know, let's get this out of the way. Apparently, today is another white shirt Wednesday.
#WSW.
Yeah.
Right.
Despite my continued insistence that I have a very specific color shirt schedule, the light blue on Monday, the darker blue on Tuesday, Wednesday is always white, and then laundry day is Wednesday, so I can start over again with the light blue shirt. Emma insists on wearing white on Wednesdays.
Well, it's not an insistence. I mean, I think you should take it about how cool of a lady I am, that I don't really think about my wardrobe that much. Well, at least that's how I'd like to present it. I don't even remember. I wore
cool
orange.
Cool of a lady?
Right. I'm of a cool lady. I wore orange on Monday. I don't remember what I wore yesterday. But those weren't coordinated. I chose this shirt based on the weather. It's unfortunate.
It's
I wore my glasses today.
It's unfortunate. Right? I don't know. It's unfortunate. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, maybe I get to post the schedule of my shirt wearing, because it is. Always
the
same.
We have the Google Calendar. Why don't you just do that?
I should do that. Or I should do that. Reminder.
You can just switch up your shirt rotation one time.
That I cannot do.
Well.
Asking for trouble.
That can't happen. No, then I go into a mild state of panic. I wouldn't know what to do. I can't spend that time thinking about that. That's why I have a schedule. Meanwhile, let's go to this. We, you know, mentioned early up front here that that gun control has has moved to the forefront again of the national conversation. The reason why it is unlikely to pass, or at one of them, but the probably one of the biggest ones, at least, before you can even have a conversation, is because of the filibuster. And yesterday, Mitch McConnell reiterated his threat to Democrats if they, and we should make it clear, the filibuster is gone for judicial nominees, both Supreme Court and federal judicial. Those were two different steps. The filibuster is gone for nominees of cabinet secretary, of Senate, of positions in the administration requiring Senate confirmation. That's gone. All those things have been rolled back by Democrats and Republicans over the past 10 or so years, essentially because Republicans were so relentless in obstruction. And now Mitch McConnell, you'll remember Mitch McConnell is the one who prevented a Supreme Court nominee from getting a hearing because it was only a year out from an election, is claiming that if the Democrats get rid of the filibuster for legislation, he's going to go scorched earth. And I think in part, I think there's a strategy of why he came out and said this blatantly false assertion about the filibuster yesterday. This is Mitch McConnell on Capitol Hill.
Is not rooted in racism. Historians differ on this. Are you concerned about the perception? If it is used against advancing voting rights, certainly the public perception is that Republicans are going to use this tool to make it harder for black people to vote.
Yeah, actually, historians do not agree. It has no racial history at all. None. So there's no dispute among historians about that. I make no apologies for opposing this bill. You've heard Senator Blunt outline the various flaws involved in it. This is all about a power grab. If it were related to civil rights, why were the Democrats using the tool last year and the year before that and the last 6 years? Why is it all of a sudden a civil rights issue when it wasn't for them as recently as last year? Honestly, with all due respect, that is nonsense. This is a power grab. It's all about trying to take over the American election system. It has all kinds of flaws. And under Senator Blunt's leadership, we're going to begin to point them out in great detail starting tomorrow in the Rules Committee.
Now, they're talking about H.R. 1, or now introduced in the Senate as S-1. This is a voting rights bill. It also has anti-corruption measures, too, in terms of our elections and in terms of transparency for donations. But it is just simply a fact that the filibuster, particularly, it has changed over the past 20 years because McConnell started to deploy it in every circumstance possible, imaginable. But for the first, I don't know, 50, 60 years in the existence of the filibuster, it was deployed primarily for to stop the expansion the expansion of rights for black people and voting rights for people in this country, but really just sort of like the creation of parity of rights to some degree.
Yeah, and it was deployed so sparsely and only really specifically for the purpose of blocking civil rights legislation that Northern Democrats at the time, or Northern liberals, kind of just allowed the Southern racists to use it because they wanted to kind of throw them a bone for other legislative priorities like the New Deal back in the day to get through. There's a quote Adam Gentleson took from Senator Richard Russell in 1949, where he basically admitted that this was really about blocking civil rights legislation. So there's no real differing historical data on this. The proof is in the pudding. This was how things worked back when the filibuster was being utilized decades before. He's trying to muddy the waters, McConnell, now. And frankly, I actually think it's one of the best strategies he's deployed since he's now become the minority leader, because now the conversation is about racism and regular people who aren't paying attention to the historical context might go, wait, yeah, they were using it back during when the Republicans were in power. How are they turning around and calling the Republicans racist when obviously, you know, there had been many Democrats even when the Republicans were in power who were saying once we are in the majority, we need to do filibuster reform.
I agree, and even to add to that, that it sort of muddies the water about the racist quality. But it also, look, during the years of Trump and Obama, all of our politics got highly racialized on both sides, and by making this about the notion that Democrats are, you know, ostensibly calling them racist because of the, you know, around the filibuster, as opposed to the fact that, like, we know their voter suppression techniques focus primarily on communities of color, particularly black people, because they know the ratio, the relationship between being black and being Democratic is, you know, 9 to 10, essentially. Maybe a little bit more. They can. They will target minority districts, black districts, and they know if they can suppress the votes there, they are going to help themselves. So yes, I agree. It's a way of racializing this issue, which it is racial, but it's a way for them to use a clarion call and get their folks in support of not getting rid of the filibuster. Frankly, I don't think it's going to work. People don't care about the filibuster, period, end of story. They care about legislation that's passed, and none of them want to own a lot of these things that they vote for or against, particularly against. But we will talk more about that in the coming days. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Alec McGillis, author of Fulfillment, Winning and Losing in One-Click America. Folks, this is a great way, particularly during COVID, but just in general, because frankly, I did it, years ago for my parents. Now, maybe two or three. I can't tell how many years ago it was. But you want to stay in touch with the people in your life. Also, you know, you get older like I am. You realize that there are going to be folks, you know, aren't going to be around, or your kids may not have the depth of the relationship with your parents or your cousins or whatever it is that you want them to have. This is a great way to stay in touch and to develop those sort of multi-generational understandings. StoryWorth, you can feel closer to your loved ones no matter what the distance is. StoryWorth is an online service, helps your loved ones share stories through thought-provoking questions about their memories and personal thoughts. It's a fun way to engage with your family, especially those you don't see in person, but also, you know, nobody's going to be around forever. Every week, StoryWorth emails your family member a different story prompts, like questions that you've probably never thought to ask of your grandparents or your parents. I guess you could do it with your kids and make cousins. Like, has your life turned out differently than you imagine it would? Like even the stuff like, what was your favorite car that you owned? I mean, anything can prompt a whole bunch of stories. And it has, in some ways, these are sort of like incidental fun stories. In other ways, it lets you learn fairly profound things about people who are close to you that you may not have realized. And what happens is after 1 year, StoryWorth compiles all the stories, including photos, if you want, into a beautiful keepsake book that's shipped for free. This is a great way to... It's great for the giver. Frankly, it's one of those gifts that like you give, and the person who's getting it's engaging to them, and it's fun for them, and they feel like people are interested. And then for you as a giver, it's actually you sort of getting a gift that's going to give for a long time. It's really the whole thing is an awesome experience. And then you get the book, you give it to your kids, they learn about their grandparents. You learn something about your parents, that type of thing. You can now give your loved ones the gift of spending time together wherever you live with StoryWorth. Get started right away with no shipping required by going to StoryWorth.com/majority. You'll get $10 off your first purchase. That's StoryWorth, one word, .com/majority for $10 off. Okay, want to welcome to the program Alec McGillis. He is a senior reporter for ProPublica, recipient of the George Polk Award, and author of his most recent Fulfillment, Winning and Losing in One Click America. Alec, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And I'm here with Emma Vigeland. I got to tell you, the book is really... It's fascinating, and it seems to be like a story of a lot of different things in many respects, but I gotta say, I think it's like one of the best books to illustrate what people are talking about when they talk about the need for a reinvigorated antitrust in this country.
Yeah.
Because it shows how much broader the danger of monopolization is than just impacting workers. And I think that's really just an impressive thing. Let's just start with this from a consumer standpoint, from like the standpoint of all of us, how many people use Amazon? Just how big is it in terms of just a retail outlet, or I guess.
Yeah, I think it's hard for us to grasp really just how enormous and dominant it's gotten, especially of course in this last year, when so many more Americans turned to sort of a one click kind of existence during the pandemic. Even before the pandemic, there were well over 100 million Prime members in America, which that you can put that up against some election numbers in midterm election years, and there's more people in Prime than voting in our democracy. Just this last year, sales went up 40% year over year, over already a huge base prior to the pandemic. 500,000 more people, 400,000 or 500,000 more people hired by Amazon. That does not even include the 500,000 truck drivers they have, which don't count as Amazon employees. This company stock went up 86% year over year. Bezos' wealth up $58 billion in a single year. The scale of their breadth of warehouse space went up 50% just in a year. What's happened last year is just, it's so hard to grasp. And I think the one reason we actually have a hard time grasping it is that we all feel to some degree complicit in it, because so many of us did rely on the company in our pandemic sort of approach. The alacrity with which a lot of Americans embraced the one-click life this last year really was kind of something to behold.
And there's a quality of the story that you tell that is in some ways similar to like what we were talking about with Walmart like 10 years ago. And I guess Walmart still maybe the biggest, I off the top of my head, I don't, but still the biggest employer, and Amazon, I guess, is number two.
Yes.
But there's another dimension to this story that is fascinating, because we have this story of wealth inequality in this country and this concept of two Americas that has gone back for a while. But you and this, I think, long, well-known story of a rural-urban divide, but you outline a story of a two Americas, but it's not necessarily urban-rural. Let's weigh into that, because that really is the essence of this on some level. There are major winners and losers that Amazon have created. Walk us through that.
Yeah, that it is the essence of it. This book actually started not as a book about Amazon, but as a book about regional inequality, these growing gaps between places in America. It's partly an urban-rural gap, but it's also a gap between cities, between sort of winner-take-all cities like Seattle, San Francisco, D.C., New York, Boston, and then a much larger group of sort of left-behind cities and towns. And and the book uses Amazon as a frame to sort of explain that problem. And it's a very handy frame because it's so incredibly ubiquitous. So it's just everywhere. So it's just a good way to take you around the country and what we're becoming as a country. But it's also a good frame because it has itself contributed to this problem, to these regional divides. Because the company has essentially, in a very blunt term, kind of sucked all this prosperity and business activity out of a whole swath of the country and then kind of concentrated it in the places where it resides, very much as other tech giants have done as well. So you end up with sort of headquarter cities like Seattle and DC that are now just have all the sort of high-paying jobs for the company. DC just got 25,000 more of these high-paying headquarters jobs in that whole HQ2 bonanza, and then you have the sort of the warehouse towns, the cities that now have to sort of settle for the $15 an hour, very grueling, very kind of atomizing warehouse jobs. And it's a situation that is really not good for either set of cities. That's the important point. It's even the winter cities are struggling with credible housing affordability problems, congestion, massive displacement of longtime residents, and then of course left behind cities struggle with blight and abandonment. So it's a very unhealthy thing for a country to be this off kilter, and we simply haven't had gaps this big between regions before. This is a new thing for us.
Yeah, I just want to put a fine point on that that last thing you said, just so that people get a notion of just how much of a change this is for the country. Now, I know you're a Western Massachusetts guy. I grew up in Worcester, Mass, which is almost like the opposite of this dynamic. Worcester has been one of the most static places, probably in the country. It never has a boom. It never has a bust. It just sort of moves along. But that's sort of the way that the country as a whole was for a long time. Like, just outline that disparity before we start going into the specifics of the two ends of these disparities.
Right. I mean, you can quantify this. I mean, back in 1980, most of the country, there were very few parts of the country that had median income that was more than 20% above the average or below 20% of the average. So the most were kind of clustered around the average. Since then, huge whole swaths of the country have now fall above or below those extreme poles. Used to be that only the deep parts of the Deep South and Appalachia would fall sort of way below the 20%. Now entire swaths in the Midwest do, and the Great Plains as well. Meanwhile, it used to be that just some suburbs of New York or DC would fall above the 20% line. Now entire sections of the coasts are above that 20% line. Another way of looking at this, in the 1960s, the 25 wealthiest cities in the country included all sorts of cities in the Midwest. Cleveland, Milwaukee, Des Moines, Rockford, Illinois, were the top 25 cities in the country in income. Now only a couple cities not on the coasts make that list. There's just been this incredible sort of sorting out and a kind of hollowing out of all these cities that used to be doing pretty darn well. And so you've ended up, it's very similar to what we have with our income inequality. I mean, we talk so much about the growth of the 1% and the top 10% and all that, to unprecedented levels of inequality. And something very similar has happened at the regional level. And it's so unhealthy for the country and for our politics.
Can you expand on how Amazon specifically got to this point then? Just track it through time, really, because Amazon started in Seattle, and then obviously it's exploded to this ubiquitous, all-powerful force in this country and worldwide that we're seeing today. But just can you track along this dynamic how Amazon grew just through, I guess, the early 2000s to now?
Sure. I mean, the way to think about this problem, this regional inequality problem, and how it relates to big tech is to think of it. So I think there are two different important points. One is that tech, by its very nature, has an agglomerating effect. That's the fancy word that the economists use, where it's a winner take all thing, where you place like Silicon Valley happens, that kind of clustering happens because innovation happens in clusters. It happens in proximity. It happens when all these, you know, great minds are kind of brought in the same place with the venture capitalists. And it's different in that sense than the manufacturing economy, where once you had a given industrial innovation, you could go out and use it, build a plant anywhere where you had labor and natural resources. But with tech, you want to be in the same place. It's that human capital is all that matters. So it's drawing that capital together. So you have that agglomerating effect. That's why Amazon moved. One reason Amazon moves to Seattle, sets up shop in Seattle, is that Microsoft is already there. And so Amazon knows that it can draw some of that human capital, some of that tech talent away from Microsoft. That's why it goes there. It also goes there because it was going to be better for its taxes to go there. So you have that sort of basic agglomerating effect, winner-take-all effect in the tech economy. But then on top of that, we have, as Sam mentioned at the outset, we have gotten so weak in our application of antitrust in our country that we've allowed the giants to get so big that and been so just soft in our approach to that the agglomerating effect gets even worse because you end up with just a handful of companies that have grown so dominant in the tech economy, which means that even more of the wealth of prosperity will be drawn to the places where those few happen to reside. If there were more of them, they would be in more places. I mean, I'm speaking very kind of crude terms here, but instead there is the one Amazon that is now so immensely dominant. So Seattle ends up with, and then now DC ends up with this extraordinary levels of hyper prosperity that are more extreme than what would exist if these giants had not been allowed to get as big as they were.
There's like these things, they're gravity, they're like gravitational pull,
right.
Grows exponentially with their size,
right.
And this notion of this agglomerating effect is fascinating. But let's talk about tax arbitrage, because that was something that in its founding, that seems to be like the Amazon and Bezos, I guess, had basically this very specific strategy, which was like, we could get paid to do the stuff that is actually going to bring us value when it comes to these the locations that we're going to land in. And we're also going to make sure that we don't pay taxes. If we can avoid taxes at all costs, that's going to be a dictating factor. Walk us through that. I mean, that has to do both with what they did online. They sort of busted in the way that like almost like Uber does did back in the day in a city. And they also placed their logistics, part of their logistics equation was taxes too.
Absolutely. Tax avoidance was at the heart of their early success and for actually for years as they grew. The way it worked was that you had this massive advantage for e-commerce as they started out in the 90s, where you didn't have to assess sales taxes on your customer the way that a physical a rival's shop with physical brick and mortar stores had to assess sales taxes. The way the law was applied was you didn't have to assess sales taxes as an e-commerce seller if you didn't have a physical building in a given state. So that's a huge reason why Amazon went to Seattle instead of Silicon Valley back in the 90s, is that if they'd set up shop in California, they would have had to assess sales taxes on all their sales in California, which is, of course, the biggest market in the country. So instead, they go to a smaller state where it doesn't cost you so much to have to assess sales taxes on those people. And then the customers in that small state. So they go to Washington State. Then as the company grows, it's very kind of strategic about where it puts its warehouses, because once you put a warehouse in a given state, you're going to have to assess sales taxes on sales in that state. So they actually avoid all sorts of larger states, large population states, for quite a long time as they're growing. Don't put warehouses there. Finally, they get to the point where the company is so dominant, is so huge, is so popular, that the and is making these it's this pledge of two-day delivery and then one-day delivery, you know, to Prime customers, where the need to be closer to your customers wherever they are, it becomes more important. So they start putting warehouses everywhere, even if it means having to assess sales taxes there. But then of course, on top of that, you have sales avoidance on many other levels as well, you know, most notably at the federal level, managing to keep their federal income tax bill incredibly low. Like in some recent years, it's been zero despite their incredible profits because of the way that they're able to move profits offshore to Luxembourg to claim huge losses. And so there's that whole game, which of course they're not alone in playing that game. A lot of the tech giants play that game. And then they're also, meanwhile, they're also reducing their tax bill by being incredibly aggressive in seeking subsidies and incentives from local communities where they're seeking to build warehouses and data centers. So even as they're basically grudgingly agreeing to start assessing sales taxes as they expand, they're also getting massive subsidies and incentives from communities where they're going in to build their warehouses. All these towns and cities that are desperate for any kind of investment or jobs are throwing tax subsidies at Amazon to build warehouses that are going to have these quite low paid jobs as the reward.
And let's be clear, I mean, even in places that aren't so desperate, during this whole HQ
right.
Thing, people were willing to throw all sorts of tax breaks for the idea that Amazon would end up providing jobs there, when in fact Amazon's going to end up providing jobs there if it's in Amazon's best interest to do so at the end of the day. I mean,
well,
that was
all that in New York City,
right?
Is what I was going to say, right? They came here anyway, albeit in a smaller capacity, but they wanted, on top of that, a bunch of taxpayer money to bribe them to come here, and it ended up, you know, they want to be have a New York presence anyway.
That's the best business move you can get, is to get paid to do something that's already in your best interest.
Exactly.
Let's go to some of the stories that tell this story of this, you know, and you said at the top that Amazon was the frame for this geographic disparity in a really unique, in the context of the history of the United States, type of disparity. And at one point, I want to circle back as to how it changes human behavior, right? Because there was a time where I'm like, oh, I'm living in Dayton. I think I'll go to, I'll go to some other random city with 200,000 people, and my life could very well be more or less the same. And you don't have that flexibility of the mobility in the same way you do if you're looking for their similarly situated opportunities. But let's look at, let's start with Bill Bodani. I don't know how to pronounce it.
Yeah, Bodani.
He really captures sort of like what has changed for a similarly situated person looking for work that isn't necessarily white collar. And he's doing this in, this is in Baltimore.
Yes, outside of Baltimore. This was really is kind of like the core chapter of the book on what's happened in this one spot outside Baltimore, where it's a place called Sparrows Point Peninsula, just outside the city, that used to be home to the largest steelworks in the entire world. Bethlehem Steel had 30,000 workers there in the late 50s, was there for the entire century, and it's a huge company town. And Bill Bodani worked there for more than 30 years, was really tough work, had, you know, physically challenging work. He had a bunch of injuries on the job, finally left the job after one of these injuries. But he really liked the work. He just felt this incredible sense of purpose there and camaraderie. And there's a reason why he stayed working there for more than 30 years, made really good money, well over $30 an hour by the end, incredible benefits. So he left that job, and then the steelworks went out of business as part of the sort of, you know, across the board decline in the American steel industry. And this, it's kind of astonishing. This entire massive steelworks, this huge skyline of industrial skyline, has been wiped completely clean off of this peninsula. It's just gone. And it's been replaced by a bunch of warehouses. It's now a big sort of logistics business park. And it includes not one, but two Amazon warehouses now. And Bill went back to work at one of these warehouses a few years ago. He was having health troubles. His wife was having health troubles. He needed some more money. And he went back for a job driving a forklift there, making a fraction of what he'd been making at that exact same location for Beth Steele, a job that was now less dangerous than the one he had at Beth Steele, but a job that he just couldn't stand. He was not only making less money, he felt no purpose on the job, had no camaraderie, had no sense of meaning whatsoever. Was constantly sort of under the beck and call of various young supervisors who were just riding him to make more deliveries on the forklift from the trucks. Not enough time for bathroom breaks. He's an older guy, had to go to the bathroom more often, never had enough time to go. Couple times ended up having to, pull up his forklift and go behind the forklift and hope the cameras wouldn't catch him. And got in trouble for trying to distribute some union literature to some of the younger workers there, kind of encouraging them to think about organizing. And finally, finally quit just a few years into the job, just couldn't hack it. And to me, that the story of his, of him in Sparrow's Point is just really, it's just so emblematic of what's happened to work in this country, sort of the kind of work that the mass of Americans, now rely on and turn to. Once it was not that long ago, was a job like the Beth Steele job. And now in that exact same location, it's the warehouse, the Amazon warehouse job. And what's been lost in that transition.
And we should say also, his pension was diminished, which is, like a whole nother, subset of this story, obviously. The stuff like with the bracelet, the electronic bracelet, like if you're dilly dallying, then you get basically a shock. I mean, it's more or less, but this, all of that just sort of, tells that disparity, and that happens in one place, but now we have this sort of the regional disparity. So let's compare, let's talk about Dayton, Ohio, because you have another person that you follow there, and he is having a very rough go of it as well. And this is to sort of show that disparity, not so much in the context of time, but in terms of location between Seattle. Tell us about Dayton.
So Dayton is such an important place, and it's an important story, partly because, it just shows what's happened to so many. It stands for so many of these Midwestern cities that were once really the kind of the font of so much innovation and prosperity in this country. And Dayton was the Silicon Valley of its time. I mean, the people say that, and it's true. It was the Wright brothers. It was all these incredible inventors and innovators in the early 20th century who came up with all these in advances that, from which so much prosperity flowed, all these automotive engineering advances, the cash register, all this stuff came out of Dayton, and the Wright brothers. And then now the city has just went through a terrible time in the first decade of the century, which is devastating to a place like Dayton. All these auto jobs, auto parts jobs lost following the China being admitted into the WTO. WTO was devastating to manufacturing towns like Dayton. Then they get clobbered by the opioid epidemic. And so you have someone like Todd Swallows, who I focus on in this chapter, a young man whose father had a successful small trucking company that took auto parts up and down the I-75 corridor up to Detroit. But that business went bankrupt in the Great Recession. And Todd is left as this young man completely on his own, trying to make his way, through a succession of just incredibly long list of low paid jobs, restaurant jobs, retail jobs, And he ends up working finally in making cardboard boxes. When I met him, he was living in a shelter with his family because their life had gotten so unstable that they're living in a large homeless shelter in Dayton while he's working for a company making cardboard boxes for Amazon. And so he's sort of at the bottom of that ecosystem, bottom of the food chain that leads all the way up to the glimmering headquarters in Seattle with Bezos and the 17th floor dog park balcony in an Amazon tower where the Amazon headquarters employees can take their dogs out for a stroll on the AstroTurf with a 17th story view of the Seattle skyline. And then there's Todd back in Dayton making the cardboard he's quite a young man. He has incredible work ethic. He's just kept at it all these years, but you can just see so powerfully the effects of his economic instability and kind of unraveling of him and the kind of the landscape around him. And he's been through, the chapter there is pretty candid about some of the things that kind of come with that kind of downward mobility and instability. And it just, it's just meant to show sort of what is really happening sort of on the ground at the one end of that ladder.
You see the knock-on effects of how it ends up. He becomes abusive and just the implications of having that amount of pressure and really finding no way to get ahead, despite the fact that he is so determined to do it. There's just no opportunity there.
It's heartbreaking. I mean, he so badly wants to be a good father and a good provider the way that his father had been for him. But it's just a different world that they're inhabiting now, just 20 years later.
I mean, you had mentioned up at the top that Amazon was a frame to show this dynamic of this new type of regional disparity, or it's not even regional, right? I mean, it's in some respects it's highly localized disparity. Is Amazon a frame for it, or is it? I mean, how much does it contribute? I mean, let's say that we were to go back in time 20, 30 years ago and say, no, you got to pay your taxes. At one point, we're going to not allow you to have such control over this marketplace that you've created. You can't take a VIG on certain things. You can't push things that, we're going to apply like a sin fin rule to the way that you do your products. You can't own the product and also own the sort of the pipes that deliver it. We were to do all this, and we figured out some way, I'm not sure how we would do that, where it's like, diminish the value of aggregating all of the techies in one area, whether it's, 128 in
Boston
or in Seattle, Austin, Texas, maybe is trying to like, would this problem still exist if we were able to just deal with Amazon, or is Amazon like a main driver, but also indicative of a bigger problem?
It's definitely both. I really see it as both. I see, and I had a lot of discussions with Amazon about this, of course, because they, I did talk to them at length for the book, and their basic counter was, if it weren't us, it'd be someone else. There are these larger structural forces, there are these changes in technology. The internet was going to happen. E-commerce was going to happen. It would have been someone else with some other name, but it just happens to be us. What I think that misses is that yes, of course there are these larger structural things that have happened, but the company has made specific decisions, and actions over the years that have made things even sort of worse in these ways. Whether it's this particularly aggressive pursuit of tax avoidance or the decision to put HQ2 in Washington, which they didn't have to do. They could have tried to make it work somewhere else. They could have tried to, make it work in St. Louis, or there being especially, the productivity demands in the warehouses being especially draconian as they are. But so Amazon's choices have made this worse than sort of the generic scenario. But by the same token, we as a country have made it worse by not doing some of the things you mentioned, by letting the giants get as big as they are, by just letting it all be so untrammeled, that we absolutely, it did not necessarily have to be this way. And we could have mitigated it, whether certain forces are still going to push us in certain directions, but things are always on a scale. I don't like thinking of things as one way or the other way. Things are on a scale. We didn't let things have to get so extreme on the scale. And it's why these fights that are looming now, in Washington, on the antitrust front are so important, because one can certainly do things to mitigate and to somewhat moderate these extremes.
So I guess that brings us to the anti. Do you want to go, Sam?
Well, I just want to pursue that one thing, because there's two things right there that we can do on the mitigation front. One is it's happening in Bessemer, Alabama. Right. That is sort of a unionization to just help workers. But the antitrust thing shows like the implications of having a corporate behemoth that has an outsized political power. We see it in the context of taxation. We see it in the context of their ability to just sort of dangle cities around by their nose or whatever it is. But is it also like an inevitability? Because I actually believe when Amazon says if it wasn't us, it would be someone else. That is an indictment of maybe our system, right? Like, I mean,
yes. Is
there a problem with capitalism, period, full stop? I mean, and maybe that's it depends on your ideological position. But it seems like they're right. If it wasn't Amazon, it would be somebody, I don't know, the Nile or whatever. some other entity.
Yes. Though again, I would say I believe in structural forces. I also believe in personal agency and kind of corporate agency and corporate responsibility. And I do believe that there are certain ways that Amazon has grown and behaved that might have been different if it were a company not led by Jeff Bezos and not led by a certain kind of ethic that came from him and kind of characterized this one company. But absolutely, we as a country, let this happen. And it really has so much to do with our just this complete shift in our approach to monopoly. And, we had a big problem with monopoly in this country around the turn of the 20th century. And we took it on. And for decades, we recognized this problem and we tried to push back on it. That fell away in the last few decades, these past few decades where we have adopted, what's known as the sort of consumer welfare approach to monopoly, where, hey, as long as the prices stay low for us to buy our stuff, nice word for it, online, what's the problem? If the prices are low, it's fine for the consumer. There's nothing to worry about. And that has been the overriding approach to monopoly and antitrust. People much smarter than me on economics have explained in recent years, all the reasons why this is flawed and why this is inadequate and why there's other ways we should be thinking about corporate power and dominance and just the distorting effects of that kind of dominance. And so very belatedly now we're revisiting this. And that's what's at stake now in Washington.
So we've reached this point as Amazon has kind of, it's hard to imagine them getting any bigger, but they could. And I think there's kind of an impasse for at least Democrats who are now in power in Washington, right? Because they have traditionally been cozy with big tech, but now yep. You have someone like Joe Biden speaking out about the Bessemer strike and speaking out in favor of the unionization, or not strike, I should say, unionization efforts down in Alabama. So what is the path forward there? Because I think this is kind of a reckoning for Democrats and their relationship with these tech behemoths and perhaps pursuing some antitrust action.
It's absolutely, you nailed it. It's an absolutely a reckoning within the Democratic Party. I mean, it was the Democratic Party has been incredibly tight with big tech for, you know, these last few decades. That has been where, that's been the affinity, really. You know, in terms of just their political leanings, their giving, and, you know, the revolving door. I mean, just so many people going from the Obama administration into big tech, including Jay Carney, you know, who's the head of the whole PR government influence, government lobbying team at Amazon. And so now the question is, you know, and then more broadly, of course, that you have the fact that Amazon's universal, but its strongest demographic really is as consumers is the upper middle class, highly educated urban consumer in big metro areas. That's the Amazon bread and butter. That's why those boxes are piled up outside New York apartment buildings, and in the lobbies. And Amazon was the amazing poll just a couple years ago, the most trusted institution in the entire country among Democrats, more than the press, more than higher education, more than unions, more than government. So there's a deep, deep affinity between big tech and Democrats, both at the sort of at the elite level and just generally speaking. And so now you have people like Elizabeth Warren, Lina Khan, people on the left who recognize how out of whack things have gotten and are very incisive about what has to be done about it. And it's going to be a fight really within Democrats. You know, is the Biden administration willing to take a different path than the Obama administration did? The Obama administration presided over 8 years of massive galloping growth by the giants. And it's going to be really interesting to see if there's a rift there and a new approach.
In fact, there was just a big release of documents about the Obama administration's handling of Google,
exactly.
We will get into on this program later. And I want to reiterate just sort of what I think is amazing about your book is that we have talked on this program many times about this sort of the change in the perspective on antitrust around that happened with Robert Bork and Ronald Reagan in the early 80s and the shift to consumer welfare as opposed to a sort of a broader perspective on it. And so if people want to understand what the implications are of a monopoly like this and its knock-on impacts that are really like, I mean, it's amazing how far down the road it goes, what's downstream from this type of monopoly. One of those things I just want to touch on before you go is that concept of the what it has done to mobility for people when they move, like the decision to go from from a Boston to a Dayton, or from a, you know, pick a city, I guess, and to another is so dramatic relative to what it was even 30 years ago. How does that play out? Like, where else do we see the implications of that?
No, it's a real problem. This lack of mobility, and it goes in both directions. You're much less likely now to make a move from a place that's struggling to a place of greater opportunity than you used to be. Those moves are happening much less often, even though you think people would want to go to the opportunity, go to the jobs. But as the gaps have gotten so much bigger, it's so hard to like come in at the lower rung of a city like a San Francisco or Seattle from a struggling place, because where would you even begin? You're going to be starting at some low wage job in one of these cities, and you simply won't be able to afford it. Like the housing affordability problem there has gotten so extreme that you don't even know where you'd latch on in a place like that, even if there's in theory more opportunity. The fact is the low wage jobs there are still low wage, and it's just really hard to afford life there. On top of that, you also have the sort of the breakdown of the family makes that kind of move much harder too. You're back in the day, the Jodes could move from Oklahoma to California, because you have Ma Jode and Tom Jode, and, you know, if Tom's working, you know, in the picking fruit in California, you know, you have Ma Jode to take care of the kids. Now with, if you're a single mom in, you know, Appalachian, Ohio, you're relying on your mom or your sisters to take care of your kids while you're working. Maybe you're not, it's going to be really hard for you to pick up with your kids and just move to, move to Northern Virginia. You know, who's going to take care of the kids while you work? It's just, that's tougher. Then going the other way, you know, it's much tougher for more conceivable for someone, a highly educated person, to take a, you know, if you see some, you know, cool job in Buffalo that seems in, you know, interesting, or in Rochester or wherever it might be. Say you're in biotech and there's some cool biotech thing in Rochester, you're much less likely to make that move than you used to be, because you're much less likely to spend your whole career in a given place. You want to have a whole bunch of companies in your field in the same place. You want the cluster as for security. And so you're much more likely to stay in Boston, because that's where you have a whole bunch of those jobs around. You also likely have a professional partner, you know, who's like you, a professional, you know, well-educated professional. He or she is going to needs a good job too. And they're going to ask, well, what am I going to do in Buffalo? It's the clustering just is constantly sort of self-reinforcing in that way. And then on top of the fact, there is the tendency of well-educated professionals, upper income people, to want to live amongst each other. That's been shown that there's the high earning people are much less likely to live in sort of mixed income neighborhoods. They seem to be taking comfort from sort of living amongst their own, in certain neighborhoods and suburbs and what have you. So all of that, just, you have this constant self-reinforcement where there's very little mobility between the two kinds of places.
It is a massive problem. And, I don't even know how we begin to address it beyond, you know, either some type of wholesale change in our system or these mitigating suggestions that you had. But Alec McGillis, it's a fascinating book. We will put a link to Fulfillment, Winning, and Losing in One-Click America on majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time.
Right. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break. Then we'll come back, wrap it up. Just got a question on the IM that just popped up that I saw we should address. Wyoming Ryan says, Sam, I own a small business. Retail sales tax is money I never owned. How does not charging sales tax help a retail business? It's money I take and hand right over. Well, apparently, Wyoming Ryan didn't have any competitors, because if he did, his competitors weren't charging sales tax and Ryan was, me as a consumer will say, well, Ryan's prices are 8% higher than Kevin's down the street. I'm going to go to Wyoming Kevin's retail business. I mean, that's how the sales tax thing was. Like, I go to Amazon, it's cheaper than it is if I buy it down the street. I'll do that. And so that was the arbitrage they were playing with sales tax. But it is a fascinating book. I don't know the answer. If it's not, you know, this is just maybe a problem with capitalism, or if there's something that we could have done, or maybe
there's
it's too far.
There's at least something we can do to stymie it now. I mean, it may return and regenerate in the way railroad monopolies do. Now it's tech monopolies, but there are temporary stopgaps, I would say.
Right. And if it is, I don't know, you can mitigate, but I don't know if you can go backwards in time. It may be the problem may be so big that we have let the cat out of the bag and it's running around and it turned into a monster.
Spraying everywhere.
That's not exactly the metaphor I wanted. All right, folks. See you tomorrow. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that had the sense like there would be music come in, and then I realized, no, it doesn't.
Happens every day.
This is breaking from Ryan Grimm right now. Chuck Schumer is telling labor leaders that a PRO Act gets a floor vote if they can find 50 co-sponsors. They're now at 45. So the question's going to be, and this is one of those things like where...
I'm in favor of forcing the vote here because we can now then see, wow, 45. Well,
you can't force the vote. He's saying we're not going to do it until we get those five other co-sponsors. But the question is, how do you find out who those five are? Well, that's pretty easy. I mean, frankly, somebody, maybe it's going to be The Intercept. I don't know. This happened during the privatization push in 2005. George Bush was pushing to privatize Social Security. Talking Points memo, Josh Marshall over there, basically started a whip count. And he started asking his readers, go and call your local representative, find out what their position is on privatizing Social Security. And they developed a whip count. And so they had an ongoing list, and they found out who was for it. And of course, just the actual process of doing that puts pressure on people.
Right.
And certainly, you know, this is, if Schumer's telling Ryan Grimm that, that's what Schumer wants.
Yes.
Schumer wants us, you.
The left. I mean, he knows who he's speaking to.
Pro-union folk, go out. Schumer's like, I can't be leader and tell you who the five are, but there's five. How hard could it be to figure it out? You go out, you find those people, and you put them on the record, and you make them be public that they are going to be, that they are not supporting this. And then, you know, then we have the question of the filibuster. But the bottom line is, there is going to be a time, and it's going to happen soon. I can't tell you when. I don't have any inside information. But it's either going to be H.R. 1 or S.1. I mean, I should say S.1. It's now been introduced. There's going to be a time where there's going to be a reckoning on this filibuster. And once the filibuster is gone, I mean, this is what's actually good about the sequencing here. If I go on the record today as being for the PRO Act, I am more inclined to do it now if I think I've got it, and I'm somewhat reluctant, let's say. I'm more inclined to do it now if the filibuster is there. If I'm somewhat disinclined to do it. I'm more inclined to do it when the filibuster is there because I don't have to take necessarily that vote or in a meaningful
way. We have names, by the way.
Oh, we do?
Yeah, that Brandon just sent. Angus King, Sinema, Mark Kelly, Manchin.
And Mark Warner.
Oh, Mark Warner. The secret villain of all of this. He just does not get enough heat.
It's true.
And it's obvious. Like, that makes a ton of sense.
If I had to guess, if I had to guess, I would have said those. I would have forgotten about any of
those. I don't think I would have said Mark Kelly. I probably would have said somebody else.
I've anticipated Mark Kelly actually being more to the right than where he's been so far.
That's why I was, I guess, maybe he lulled me to sleep.
But we will see. There's got to be... you know, I think Warner, I could see subject to pressure, and Manchin also subject to pressure. Arizona, I don't know what the dynamic is there, but there may be very well a dynamic. That's why we see that. But there it is. So anyhow, we will head into the fun half today. 646-257-3920 is the number. People are very excited about our cult-like dressing.
Yeah, it's
not like people are going to forget about it.
We either got to make it a thing, or maybe we don't have to make it a thing.
Well, I don't think we need to make it a thing at all. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to dissuade the thing from happening. It keeps
happening.
I was
about to say it has to be. We either have to make it a thing, or you know, just.
I think we have to make
never do it again.
I think we have to make a commitment to never do this again. I mean,
I know,
Wednesdays,
but I guess, but the commitment is one-sided. It's just on me, and I just have to make sure.
I only have 5 shirts. I can't like, you know, like it's either that or it's like
this is like the last of the winter again. Here, this is the last of the winter selection, and it was a little, it was in the 50s today. I didn't want to wear a blouse.
This is the problem, is that when we moved to Zoom, my whole plaid wardrobe became inoperative because it mores mm-hmm. on the video screen. That's basically what's right. the root of this. So I had to wear only my solids. And so I only have...
Five solids?
Yeah. Yeah. I just bought another gray one. So
a gray solid button-down?
Yeah. Folks, just a reminder, this show relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. It is your membership that makes this show possible. Tough times for some people, and some folks, frankly, just had enough for politics after Donald Trump. They needed a break. If you are not one of those people, if you're one of those people who are staying engaged, and you're one of those people who are not... haven't lost a job, or you're doing okay at this time and you like the show, now is a great time to support it. jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off, and AM Quickie. So there you go. Don't forget, check out Nomi's show today, the Noma Key Show. You can find it on YouTube.com or Twitch.tv, the_NomaKeyShow. Also, my sister just texted me, we have new masks in our merch at MajorityReportRadioStore.com. MajorityReportRadioStore.com. Oh, wait, is that what it is? No, it's not. It's store.MajorityReportRadio. What? What is our thing there?
Shop at MajorityReportRadio.com or shop.MajorityReportRadio.com.
Shop.MajorityReportRadio.com. Oh, there's the new masks. And one is the behind the head type. That's the ear loop. It's behind the head type. Remember, everything Union, American Union, and American made. So, ooh, look at that. I didn't know that black beanie came in there. That's pretty good. I like that one. That's pretty good.
Very nice.
There you go. So check it out. Also, Matt, what's happening on the Matt Lekian media universe?
Yeah, Thursday night on Left Reckoning at 8, we have Shama Sawant to talk about the recall effort she's fighting up in Seattle. And Wozni Lombre is going to hang out, talk about basketball. So a little bit less sports. So if you like basketball, check out Left Reckoning at 8 Eastern.
Dude, you sounded great in that right there.
Yeah.
Crystal clear.
Look at that.
Crystal clear. Feels like you're in the room. The thing that we talked about with Alec McGillis today is directly tied to Shama Sawant's, the attacks on Shama Sawant. Right? I mean, like, they don't want to pay extra taxes there.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the one-to-one. All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
Since you left me.